and analysis. And remember to support independent media financially.
You've got to start off each day with a song. Now, even when things go wrong, you feel better, you even look better. I'm here to tell you that you'll be a go-getter. Now, the way that you shake my hand will tell me how I stand. Now, isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that you can't go wrong. If you start off each day with a song, you've got to start off each day with a song.
Oh, sing it, Jimmy boy.
Even when things go wrong,
sing it for the hoi polloi.
You feel better, you even look better. Ah, that music, it does something to me. I wish I knew what it was. Last night I was telling Umbriago about my latest concerto called Tony's Pushcart. He said, Tony's Pushcart, how does it go? I said, it doesn't go, you have to push it. I got a million of them. Now you know that, so you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
If you start off each day with a song, you've got to start off each day. Boys, please, soft. Little more fortissimo. I want to relate a yarn. Turn back the pages of history and what do you see? Madison Square Garden or Odeo. And there I was, interviewing a prize-winning cow. I asked her to tell the radio public how she feels. She said, moo. She's contented. I'm contented, but her husband ain't. So what happens? The bull ups to me. I ups to him, and without any preliminaries, I'm flat on my back. Being a gentleman, I apologized. But the bull's not satisfied. He demands an autopsy. So I grabs him by the tail, and what happens? He flips his tail. I lands on his head. He flips his head. I lands on his tail. He's playing ping pong with me, and I'm losing. Just then, the bull is ready to charge again. I gets an idea. I start singing, south to the border, down Mexico way. And what happens? The bull starts crying. But irregardless, I keeps on singing. This time with the castanets. That's too much for the bull. He collapses. A cheer goes up. I'm saved. And the moral is, you gotta start off each day with a song. You've gotta start off each day with a song.
Oh boy, you're singing now.
Even when things go wrong.
Oh Jimmy, you're a wow.
You feel better. You know, I'm walking down Broadway and who taps me on the shoulder? My pal. Hit him in the head, Schwartz. I said, who are you working for now? And he said, the same bunch, the wife and the kids. Now, isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that, so you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
If you start off each day with a song.
Thank you, Jimmy. I guess it's all a matter of perspective. I don't want to shut the country down. I want to open it up. But people protest and rally in different ways. I'm David Rothenberg. The program is Any Saturday on listener-sponsored WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. It is the 2nd of October, one of my two favorite months, October and May. I opened the windows and got under the blanket at night. And that's the way I like it. I could feel the fresh air on my face and the warmth on my body. Well, let's start things off with two of my pet peeves that I've been kvetching about forever. And they've come together and it's almost the perfect storm. One is the bikes and the motor scooters and the skateboards. I've become the cranky old man, but I'm also have been hit twice by bikes. I've been thrown back a half a dozen times because they don't stop at lights when the traffic is heavy. Many do not use the bike lanes. They go the wrong way. They're on the sidewalk. They speed around corners against the light. And I'm vigilant about it, watching, and I still get surprised because they come out from between cars. My second great concern has been people walking down the street, up and down stairs at the subway, reading their smartphones. And what I've been watching is, and what concerns me, and this is an issue for the current mayor and the next mayor, is the number of people who are crossing the streets again with the lights, with their reading their dumb phones, with their ears plugged in, listening to whatever inanities are coming across. And they're not watching and they're not listening. And the bikes and the motor scooters are speeding around. And we are going to have a crisis of injuries if there isn't some law and order for the traffic. I think one of the things, start giving tickets to the motorbikes that don't stop at red lights and go through, or the bikes that cut off cars that are making turns and they're going against the light. There has to be some imposition by the government to protect the lives of the many. The few have to be held accountable, not punished, held accountable. And the word will get out quickly that there's some law and order about our traffic. Digest that and protest. Here's Rosemary Clooney with a Sondheim song. This is How I Feel About Y'all.
And say, isn't Rosemary Clooney on the program tonight?
Certainly.
Well, where is she? Come up with it.
Easy now. Remember your dizzy spells.
Don't be such a hoarder. Bring Rosemary on.
Okay. Rosemary.
Yes, Bing?
Look what just crawled in, Rosemary.
Hi, Rosie.
Hello, you wonderful man.
Oh, this girl knows.
Hey, old friend, are you okay? Old friend, what do you say? Old friend, are we or are we unique? Time goes by, everything else keeps changing. You and I, we get continued next week. Most friends fade, or they don't make the grade. New ones are quickly made, and in a pinch, sure they'll do. But us, old friend, what's to discuss? Old friend, here's to us, who's like us? Damn few. Hey, old friends, how do we stay old friends? No one can say old friends how an old friendship survives. One day, chums, having a laugh, a minute. One day comes, and they're a part of your lives. New friends pour through the revolving door. Maybe there's one that's more. If you find one, that'll do. But two old friends, especially you old friends, here's to us, who's like us. discuss old friends. Here's to us, who's like us? Damn few.
What was all that racket you were making in the kitchen last night?
Oh, I was having more fun.
What were you doing?
I was running a stack of your records to the garbage disposal. Why don't you breeze, Busty? You're not needed here. It only takes two to tango, you know. Go, boy.
You ready, Rosie?
I'm with you, Rod.
We're gone.
Obviously, from a radio soundtrack, Hope and Crosby, Stephen Sondheim's song, and this arrangement and band conducting by John Otto, O-D-D-O, John Otto. I'm trying to get to a sense of normalcy, and it for me, that means going to the Y to swim, going to the movies, returning to the theater, having dinner with friends, masked, three-vax, booster in place, avoiding people not vaxxed if I have such a choice. Went to see Death in Venice, the movie. I thought I had seen it, and I realized right away I hadn't. I read the book years ago. I was playing at the Quads, and I was interested or reinterested in Thomas Mann's story after talking last week with Colin Toybin about his wonderful book, The Magician, a novel based on the life of the German author Thomas Mann. And Visconti did a very curious thing with the movie. It's almost pantomime. Dirk Bogarde dressed up like Gustav Mahler, who was the inspiration for the movie. Mahler, can you imagine when you read the book, the Manns are saying, let's have Gustav and Clara over. Can you imagine just saying, let's have the Mahlers over for dinner? I can't get over that. I wonder if in Germany, are the Hitlers available tonight? So I thought I was going to be bored because it was all happening inside the head of Dirk Bogarde, or the character that based on Mahler. And yet it works. 2 hours and I was riveted. It's Death in Venice by Thomas Mann, made into a movie by Luciano Visconti. And we had so many calls for the book, The Magician. We sent some out, but I've reordered. So if you still want to get a copy of The Magician and as part of your tithing to WBAI, $50 for a copy, you can email me at drothenberg@fortunesociety.org. Give your phone number. Your address would make it easier for me when I call you over the weekend, and we'll get you a copy of Colm Toybin's wonderful novel. It was the lead book, you may recall, last Sunday in the New York Times Book Review. He's been profiled in The New Yorker. When they do all the book novel fiction awards this year, I'm sure The Magician will be high in it. I had read it weeks before the critics discovered, and I was so happy they agreed with me. I just crawled into a corner and read. It's one of those big round novels that you want to stay with. Colin Tobin's The Magician. I also saw The Many Saints of Newark, the prequel to the television series The Sopranos, of which I was an aficionado. And the prequel doesn't make it. It's it lacks the irony and the sophistication and the characters. There was one thing that happened, though, and that was when and it all takes place 15 or 20 years before we saw it. Tony Soprano, interesting, as a teenager, played by James Gandolfini's son, who's a young actor, and he plays him as a teenager. But a baby is born, and they the family's all around, and we're naming him Christopher. And I found myself yelling, Christopher. Do you remember that? If you saw The Sopranos, when Christopher agreed to have his girlfriend, Adriana, who Adriana had apparently opened her mouth about. I can't even remember what the specifics were, but Michael Imperioli, wonderful as Christopher, gave the okay for her to be offed. And she's taken on a ride, and you just hear her in the woods yelling, Christopher, Christopher. And so here's the baby being born. And I said, oh, do you have a future ahead of you, kid? Go see it. It's, you know, all the people that were involved with the David Chase, who created The Sopranos, and all of the people that were around with the production originally are involved in it. It's not terrible. It just doesn't have the zest and the intrigue. And the character that Edie Falco played, the wife of Tony Soprano, does not exist in it. And she was, and you realize her absence is so great. Anyway, that's what I saw. At the theater, I went to see a show that we have been telling you about, Between the Bars. And I went with about a dozen of the residents at the Fortune Academy, the castle, all formerly incarcerated people. And interesting, because in the very intimate here theater, you're almost in the waiting room. It all takes place in the waiting room of a jail. And the men that are there are visited by wives and girlfriends and mothers and lawyers and social workers. And one of the people told me afterwards, and I realized something, that in all my years going in and out of prisons, I almost never went into the visiting room. I was either going to speak or tour, or I had a class for years at Rahway. I wasn't in the waiting room. So, but one of the guys said to me, it was like the waiting room is like a soap opera, because there are so many little dramas happening around you. Usually you're so preoccupied with your own guest. But if you were just sitting there watching, which the author, who was the mother of a former jail inmate, Lynn Byrne, she got the pulse of it. And it's at the Intimate Here Theater, and it's exactly the kind of theater that off-Broadway and off-Broadway should be doing, because this is not a play that would appear on Broadway. But it's very intense and compelling and eye-opening for me. And so the actors are wonderful. And so I called and said, can we get more tickets? And we did for this week for Between the Bars. It's at the Here Theater, which is on, it's a Here Arts Center. They have a couple of theaters there, all little intimate places. You're practically in the waiting room in the show. It's on at 145 6th Avenue, which is about, I was saying, two blocks south of Houston. It's about three blocks. And there's a nice little plaza right in front of the building. And so if you get there early, as we did, there are benches and whatnot, and we sat around and talked. But for Between the Bars, we have tickets this week, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at 8:30, and Saturday and Sunday at 4. So there are two matinees and 5 evening shows. I think it's worth it. It's for those of you who want theater to be, it's not Aladdin, and it's not a big Broadway musical. It's an intimate, intense, introspective. It's almost an investigation of what's happening to people who are marginalized at crisis. So I recommend it. Quite good. It's quite good. And a couple of apologies for those of you who are who have ordered the book, Putting It Together by James Lapine. I apologize. We have it on order. The publisher keeps pushing back the date when we'll get it. They're talking about warehouse, and don't you know there's a pandemic going on? You know, during World War II, that was the big line with waitresses. Can I have some butter? Don't you know there's a war going on? Well, we're getting a little of that pandemic-wise from the publishing houses. So if I apologize, you will get your copy of Putting It Together. I stay on top of it. Ain't doing much good. And for the many of you who, I think over 100 people from listeners have seen the stunning performance of Ruben Santiago Hudson in Lackawanna Blues. Two performances were canceled because he had a back injury. And I will get to you when they get to me. They have a lot of Ruben's back in the show. He's performing, but they had to postpone the opening. And not only do they have the 40 WBAI people to reschedule, which they will, they have hundreds of other people who were canceled out for those two performances. So I've talked to the company manager. We will get the tickets. As soon as I know, you'll know. I'm getting many emails saying, who, ha, ho, when? And my answer is, when I know, you'll know. I'm also getting a lot of people calling and emailing me about what should I do about the election. Boy, am I the last one to ask. I've been trying to get a ballot since Harold Stassen was running for office. Let me just tell you, if Donald Trump might have a legitimate beef about this election with Pacifica, because I can't, I'm a voter. I can't get the ballot. I've gotten, don't ask. They got to get their act together if they want us to take it seriously. Let me tell you. How's that for creating some stir? All right. So I want to remind you, if you want to see Between the Bars, $45 for a pair of tickets. And email me at drothenberg@fortunesociety.org. It's not a light evening. I mean, there are moments. It's not that intense, but it's theater, you know, with a capital T. Here's the wonderful late Al Hibbler with the song that made him famous.
After the lights go down low, baby, you know, there'll be no reason for teasing me, sir. And when the dancing is through and folks will be few, I'll be here sitting with no one but you. And I'll be needing you, sir, after the lights go down low. I wanna hold you, squeeze you as tight as I can. I'd like to kiss you and please you and make you understand. And when you thrill me, you fill me with love so divine. Together we can have a good time. When the lights go down low, baby, you know, there'll be no reason for teasing me so. And we can cuddle up near, without any fear, 'cause I've got some sweet talk that you wanna hear. And I'll be needing you so, hey, after the lights go down low. And I'll be needing you so, after the lights go down low. And I'll be needing you so, after the lights go down low.
Al Hibbler. I love you know, I'm sitting here at my computer, which is how I'm hooked up. The pandemic has brought the radio studio into my home. And here I sit, I'm connected by the computer. So I'm getting your messages right away. Here's a good one. Who's going to enforce regulations on e-bikes? Cops are still licking their grievances over being held accountable for murdering innocent black people. They're doing their jobs. I live in Long Island. The cops are non-existent in enforcing local speed limits. Well, how about in a life-saving ticket cops, not part of the NYPD, but a new entity? We can find some jobs for people and stand at key corners. And I think once tickets are bikers, motors, particularly the motor scooters and those electric things, once the word is out that tickets are there, that it will, people will start shaping up. But that's my suggestion if I were in charge, and I'm not. And that's why I'm glad I'm not. Thank you, Hilton, for this message. Finally, we agree on two reviews. The Many Saints of Newark was very disappointing, and Between the Bars was both triggering and luminous. I don't know what triggering means, but I guess it means it started conversation. Well, we certainly talked about it afterwards. And it was nice. The actors came out and we chatted with them and at the Hia Theater. So it's about 8:25. This is about the time that I do something called Out on a Limb. It is an essay I do every week. And makes me a lot of, I get a lot of friends from it, but I also get a lot of people like, well, you know, you have an opinion that everybody's not going to agree with you. I'm always surprised when people don't agree with me. I'm so wise. How could they not? By the way, my friend Pam, who sends me, hold on, a little sip of water to wet the whistle. My friend Pam sends me things that are supposed to make me laugh. Most don't, but every now and then I get a good giggle. She sent me a whole bunch about old age jokes. Not funny, except the couple, the elderly couple. The minister says, it's at an altar. And the minister says, I want you to repeat the vows. And the man says, A-E-I-O-N-U. That made me laugh. So I'm going to do it. I'm David Rothenberg. The program is any Saturday. I have to do this for the FCC every half hour. It is such a boring, I mean, you know that it is, and they don't really care that I announce it, but it's a way of catching you. So I am David Rothenberg. The program is any Saturday. You're listening to listener-sponsored WBAI 99.5 FM in the city of New York. Riveting information for you. It's announced in the paper today that we've reached the 700,000 mark, deaths from COVID, 700,000. And this week, Nicki Minaj, the pop singer, apparently had something to say about vaccinations not working, and she became the gospel. The anti-vaxxers were quoting Nicki Minaj. The scientists know, the doctors know, Fauci's a fake. Nicki Minaj is the new guru on vaccinations, all of which has inspired the following words from me for Out on a Limb. When, where, and who determined that taking a vaccination to fight COVID was tantamount to surrendering your freedom? As one processor's placard boasted, I won't give up my freedom for your fear. Well, Guy, back to the drawing board about the meaning of freedom. You know what freedom is? Haitians at the Texas border pleading for their lives. That's about freedom. Integrated buses in the 60s going through Mississippi. That was about freedom. Women in Texas today hoping to control their life choices about their own body. That's about freedom. I'm currently in contact with three people who are important in my life whose compromised bodies are enduring chemo and or radiation. All three are vaccinated, but their choices, their freedoms are greatly limited because exposure to COVID could be life-threatening because they could, even though they're vaccinated, they could be exposed to it. And most of us who are vaccinated, if we get the virus, because we're vaccinated, we'll be able to ward it off. Not so easy for those that are now undergoing chemo or radiation. Clearly, the anti-vax brigade has chosen to ignore the freedom of others. They're not only misguided and self-absorbed, they are historically inaccurate, perverting the word freedom, which in fact comes with responsibility. Those self-deluded, self-proclaimed freedom fighters need a class in Democracy 101, civics for beginners, and some religious compassion. The government is not taking away anyone's freedom when they provide guidelines for your safety and protection, like traffic lights that lessen the possibility of cars crashing into one another, wounding and killing citizens. Can you imagine someone saying that traffic light is imposing on my freedom? I can't go zooming through. When government functions best is when it responds to citizen cries for traffic lights or safety belts or life-saving vaccinations. Your fear of catching COVID is real. Almost all of us know someone who has died or suffered severely from this plague. We are cautious about riding a subway, entering a restaurant or the theater, mildly assured when they ask for proof of vaccinations, and wearing masks is a must. An unvaccinated person is a threat to our health, our safety, our life. The fear is rational. The protest is threatening. Here's how I see it. Place yourself in the middle of 42nd Street and Broadway. Traffic's coming at you from both directions. You might make it through safely, but your chances of being sideswiped or hit is far greater than if you were situated on the sidewalk. Why would anyone's freedom be compromised if I wanted to live a little bit longer? Some self-proclaimed activists confuse freedom with self-absorption and democracy from cruel indifference. When an apartment building collapsed in Miami, dozens were killed, others injured, hundreds left homeless. Immediately, the public, the media, political people wanted to know what shortcuts were taken, how many dollars were saved, went into making an imperfect structure. Some political figures, like Trump the Lump, made deregulations a priority, a philosophy that says government has no right to insist on minimum safety and health guidelines. They argue that each entrepreneur should have the freedom to determine the what and the how. And when a building or a bridge collapses, the cry is heard, how did that happen? Upton Sinclair's early 20th century novel, The Jungle, exposed the shortcuts in meatpacking plants, armor specifically, which could explain many sicknesses and deaths that came from contaminated food, corporate shortcuts to increase profits. The public clamored and the government responded with a Pure Food and Drug Act, protecting people's health. By the way, there was a story in the paper that I caught quickly about an inspector being arrested for taking bribes, about food being put into institutions. Contaminated food, I may add. Whose freedom was compromised? Now, Ralph Nader's campaign for safety belts followed a similar path to the drug laws. The big auto companies balked about the added costs, but Nader has proven that thousands of lives have been saved. Responsible government leaders followed Nader's guidelines, which were imposed on Ford and General Motors, who were concerned mostly about profits. Freedom can be complicated. I recall when 3 out of 4 doctors preferred Camels, or was it Chesterfield? I can't remember. But we did know that the tobacco industry had bought off the American Medical Association. But science and scientists prevailed, and now at least you are forewarned. You still have the freedom to invite throat cancer in, but you've been forewarned. Democracy and freedom are not singular experiences. They exist in a hopefully civil society, because I and you are not the only person on the planet or on the bus. Freedom implies we're all in this together. A few anti-vax fanatics keep emailing me that the drug companies reap enormous profits. Well, that's hardly breaking news. We're not being asked to pay for planet-saving anti-COVID vaccines, though. And if you want to challenge the sometimes obscene profits of the drug industry, let me suggest you bypass the free vax that we're getting for COVID and find out the profits being made from Viagra, penicillin, and all the prescription drugs that our insurance companies are paying. Selectivity and intelligence during a plague is suggested. Otherwise, you're aiding and abetting a mass slaughter. Americans guzzle whiskey, snort cocaine, shoot heroin, take prescription drugs en masse, and suddenly some equate freedom with not taking a vaccination. I could point the finger at Trump. He certainly legitimatized paranoia and sedition, but at some point, each person has to decide for themselves. My freedom, my life is threatened by your failure to be vaccinated. Welcome to my world. I'm David Rothenberg, out on a limb. And I want to introduce the next singer. Her name is Mickey Guyton. I never heard of her before, but I heard her this week and learned that she is the first African-American woman to break through in the ostensibly all-white world of country and Western music. There have been a few male African-American men, but she's the first woman to break through. And so I Googled, and I learned how to hear a song on Google. And here's her singing of Black Like Me. Mickey Guyton, G-U-Y-T-E-N, T-O-N.
Little kid in a small town, I did my best just to fit in. Broke my heart on the playground when they said I was different. Oh, now I'm all grown up and nothing has changed. Yeah, it's still the same. It's a hard life on each. Work day and night for an old house and a used car, just to live that good life. It shouldn't be twice as hard. Oh, now I'm all grown up and nothing has changed. Still the same. It's a hard life on easy street. Just white paint and picket fence as far as you can see. If you think we live in the land of the free, you should try to be. Fences, far as you can see. And if you think we live
Interesting, isn't she? Nice sound. I don't know if I would call that. I guess it's country and western. They say it is. Those more in tune with that genre probably could let me know if that in fact is an accurate description. I have a story to tell you. It's part four of a story that's had a continuing. It's a continuing saga. For those who have not heard it before, I will start from the beginning, and those who have heard it, stay tuned because there's an interesting conclusion. Oh, a couple of months ago, I received a letter from AT&T, my old friends, who have provided me with phone service for about 35 years. And they told me that they were discontinuing service in New York City, and that I should find another whatever you call it, another company to take my money. And I toyed with Verizon, and I finally settled on Spectrum, and Spectrum told me it would be about 2 weeks before that all the computers could legitimately set up my phone. And AT&T then, when they found out that Spectrum was coming, turned off my phone. So I had no phone, no landline. And I called. Finally, after speaking to many, many tape recordings, I found a live person. And I told them, I asked if I could have another 2 weeks with AT&T to conclude my 35 years. And I was told that they had no record of me. I did not exist. I told them that I was paying a bill on time for 35 years, never had a dispute. And they said, ostensibly what they said, well, that's your story. We have no record of you. And for 2 weeks, I had no service. And then I got a bill from AT&T for $28 for the extra 2 weeks. They found me. Well, I was so, what's the proper word? Annoyed. With AT&T, and I said, I ain't paying them $28.80. And I finally told my friend Richard, who was also an attorney, and he said, pay the $28. You don't need the bad credit rating that they can give you. And I said, you mean that powerful company cannot give me service, charge me falsely, and then hurt my credit rating? And he said, pay the $28.80. And that was the tone he used, I may add. And I paid the $28.80. And a week later, I heard from my old friends at AT&T said I owed $5.50 for late payment, $5.51 for late payment on my $28.80 bill. So I said, what do I do? Well, I think it was $5.51, and I made out a check for $5.50 and sent it to them. And lo and behold, last Saturday, I got a bill that I owe them a penny. AT&T, they didn't ask for blood, but they were pretty close. And so I took out the bill, I got a penny, and I pasted it to the bill and sent them. Let us hope that that's the final chapter of the AT&T saga. Do you know how much they spend on television advertising to lure you and me to use their services? And yet they spent how much on a stamp? We'll talk about the Postmaster General. That's another story. So that's the end of the AT&T saga. We have tickets for a new show that's coming. Well, the show isn't new. This production is George Bernard Shaw's Mrs. Warren's Profession, David Stoller's wonderful Gingold Theater Group, if you've ever seen them, coming to Theater Row with great actors, Broadway actors, Robert Cuccielli, who is the original Jekyll and Hyde on Broadway, Karen Zimba, who has won a Tony Award, all fine actors. Mrs. Warren's Profession, which is, I'm Shavian in the sense that I love the Shaw plays. And Mrs. Warren's Profession, I did not know, had been banned in England when it opened, because there was a lady of easy, Mrs. Warren's Profession, she was a woman of easy, not easy virtue, of questionable virtue. She was a prostitute or a madam, as it were. Why do I think I saw Wendy Hiller play that? Did she ever do it on Broadway? I think that I may have seen it. I know that there was a German version with Lily Palmer, but it's Shavian wit and social probing and needling of the hypocritical mores. You know, in England, where gentlemen had their visits to the local red light district, and then the same men were protesting a play that reflected on it. So it's coming to New York. Oh, it played in New York many years ago, I think, with Wendy Willis. Somebody wiser than they will tell me. But it's coming to Theater Row on West 42nd Street. And previews start Tuesday, October 12th. And we have tickets for Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday at 7 o'clock, Friday and Saturday at 8, and matinees on Saturday and Sunday. So if you're Shavian is to be a follower of Shaw, I invite you to support BAI with a $50 gift. Email me at drothenberg@fortunesociety.org. Announce that you would like to see Mrs. Warren's Profession. And why not? What an opportunity for you to see this. Have you seen Shaw? What's my favorite Shaw? Arms and the Man, Miss Alliance, Don Juan and Hell. What am I missing? I should go back to and Mrs. Warren's Profession. I've seen so much of Shaw, and I can't remember all the titles. But I invite you to support BA and to go to the theater. You have to be vaccinated. I know some of you will gripe about that, but that's what you have to do. Here's El Volo. Is that who's next, Sean? I think so. I can't even find my music sheet. Il Volo, these three Italian young men who sing up a storm, if you will.
You're on the road, but you've got in the maze of her imagination, you love this town. Even if that doesn't ring true, you've been all over, and it's been all over you. It's a beautiful day. Oh,
You know, those three young men were singing solo, and in Italy they have something called the concerto, and I was so privileged those few months that I was living in Rome back in the 60s that Pietro Garinè and his wife, he was the impresario of the Teatro Sistina, he was to be a judge at a concerto up in the mountains, and all the great singers of Italy were there. And the pops, the real pop singers of the country. And apparently years later, at one of the Contagiros, these three young men were participants. And a manager or an agent or someone said, you three together would be beautiful. And Il Volo was created. Another email, Alan from a hamlet that's so bucolic you can't stand it, saw the play we were talking about, Between the Bars. He said, it was so good, it leaves you feeling raw, but so important to see. Thank you. So I want to remind you that earlier we announced tickets for Between the Bars at the Here at the Arts Center. And also, just a little bit later, did we tell you about George Bernard Shaw's Mrs. Warren's Profession? Good theater for you to see and support. Listener-sponsored WBAI. You know what I discovered this week? That Instagram has 3.5 billion participants. I don't know what they do. I guess it's all from their phones. All those people you see walking down the street looking at their phones while they're crossing against the light. TikTok reached 1 billion. All I knew about TikTok is that Trump didn't like them. And then I heard that Kim Kardashian has 65 million people or so, give or take a couple, who tune into her every word. And others in that million category include LeBron James and Justin Bieber, and who knows who else. So are all of those people that are walking down the street looking at phones while they're walking, then they're not getting information about getting vaccinated. They're tuned into Instagram and TikTok and Kim Kardashian and LeBron James and Justin Bieber and Minnie and Nicki Minaj giving them wise information about vaccinations. And the fake news is winning. It was in Network, which was made in 1976. And everybody remembers the line, not everyone, but many people remember the famous line, Peter Finch, the TV news man. This is Patty Jayefsky at his best, opening the windows, yelling, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. But there's another scene that's even more devastating today. The Peter Finch character, the newsman, is talking to a group of people who are adoring him and following his every word. And he says, you're the reality. You out there, you're the real ones, not us. With all the reality shows that are going, the Real Housewives of Paducah. I've said that I want to do a show called Husbands from Hackensack. All those real live things, they are, that's scripted and it's illusionary. You watching it, you're the real person. And nobody, it all started with the, what was that family on PBS? It began with an L. They had a gay son and the mother, and the family got, the couple got divorced. The Laird family, somebody will remember them. Remember them on PBS? So we're living, our lives are being dictated by what Trump called fake news, but the fake, he was accusing the legitimate news, those that are, have trained reporters and fact-checked people like the New York Times and the Washington Post and CNN. That's what he called the fake news, and all the undocumented dribble that's coming in that I get from emails about the vaccinations are coming from fake news. It's rather extraordinary, isn't it? From the Broadway musical, Follies by Stephen Sondheim, one of the most beautiful ballads ever written. The Louds. Thank you, Barbara. The Louds. I knew it was with an L. Isn't that funny how the mind works? L-O-U-D-S. That was the family. That was the first reality show. And thank you, Barbara, for the Louds. Everybody stop. We know it's the Louds. Stephen Sondheim wrote a song in this called Too Many Mornings, and it all takes place. It's a reunion of old Follies people who were in the Follies. And the John McMartin character runs into Dorothy Collins, and apparently they were lovers years ago and both married other people. And they sing this song. When you know that background, it's one of the most, it's not sentimental, one of the most, in, that he could get so much of, so much emotional insight in a single song. And after we talk with Stephen Sondheim, after we hear Stephen Sondheim's song, we'll be talking with author Robert H. Mayer, who's written a book. Well, we'll wait till he comes on and we'll tell you about it, but it's a sizzler. Here is John McMartin and Dorothy Collins from Follies.
Too many mornings, waking and pretending I reach for you. Thousands of mornings, dreaming of my girl. All that time, wasted, merely passing through. Time I could have spent, so content, wasting time with you. Too many mornings, wishing that the room might be filled with you. Morning to morning, turning into days. All the days that I thought would never end. With another day to spend, all those times I look up to see Sally standing at the door, Sally moving to the bed, Sally resting in my arms, with her head against my head.
Don't kiss me, Ben. I think I'm gonna die.
Oh, I planned what I'd wear tonight, and when should I get here? How should I find you? Where I'd stand, what I'd say in case you didn't remember, how I'd remind you. Did we ever feel so happy then?
It was always real.
I should have worn green.
And I've always loved you.
I wore green the last time.
We can always feel.
In pretending I reach for you.
How many mornings are there still to come?
How much time can we hope that there will be?
Not much time,
but it's time enough for me.
Martin and Dorothy Collins from Stephen Sondheim's Follies. I'm David Rothenberg. The program is any Saturday on listener-sponsored WBAI 99.5 FM in the city of the Big Apple, New York. Good morning, Robert Mayer. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Thank you. Where are you? Where am I talking? Are you in Philadelphia?
No, I'm in Bethlehem, north of Philadelphia, so just about 70 miles from Manhattan.
I suspected, Philly, you're nearby because of the area code. Your book, In the Name of Emmett Till, when I read it, I said, not only should every adult read this, but when I hear the talk about curriculum and kids in high school not getting the history, what a perfect book this would be for every high school senior to read. Because it not only tells a chunk of history in my lifetime, but it also is the role that children who are now in high school, what their grandparents at their age, what they were doing. So ostensibly, I'll just give you this and then I'll ask you a lot of questions. You tell the story of the savage killing of Emmett Till in the mid-50s in Mississippi. And within a decade, how the kids, that his peers, the 10-year-olds and the 12-year-olds of the 50s, that when they became high school seniors and college freshmen, how that I don't know how to describe the murder, the savage murder of Till, how it changed our history from the kids. I must say, if there are probably people that don't know the Emmett Till story. And as I read it, and I read it in the news when it happened, it comes back. Tell us the story of Emmett Till and then the slow evolvement of the students, of the children that you talk about.
Right. Yeah, it's really hard to talk about Emmett Till. He was a 14-year-old boy living in Chicago with his mom. And this was in 1955, and he asked her, can I go down to the Mississippi Delta to visit my cousins? And she said yes, a little begrudgingly, and he went down, was spending time with them, having a good time. And one day they're in Money, Mississippi, just a little near Greenwood where he was staying. He goes into a store to buy some bubble gum, and he encounters Carolyn Bryant, a white woman behind the cash register. She's the wife of the owner. And he does something in the store. We don't know exactly what. He may have put the money in her hand or he might have left the store saying goodbye without saying ma'am, which would have violated Jim Crow rules for African-American behavior. And then when she leaves and is walking down the ramp, he lets out a wolf whistle, which would have been a major violation of that code, and because it's sexual implications. And his cousins know that he's made a major mistake. They grab him, throw him in the car, hope it's going to blow over, but it doesn't. A couple of days later, Carolyn Bryant's husband shows up at the house where he's staying. He and his stepbrother kidnap Emmett Till. They torture him, and they brutally murder him, and they dump his body in the Tallahatchie River. And they're tried, and in a farcical trial, they're acquitted by an all-white jury. But as you mentioned, a lot of the young people living in Mississippi and in the South, and actually a lot of young African Americans throughout the country, see the photo of Emmett Till in Jet magazine. His mom, Emmett's mom, says, "Let the world see what they did to my boy." So she has the body brought back to Chicago for an open casket funeral, allows a picture of his body to be taken by a photographer from Jet magazine. And that photo, which is horrendous, becomes, I guess what we would say today, viral in the black community primarily. So,
Robert Mayer, if he had been a Mississippi child, kid, boy, do you think it would have had the attention? The fact that I always wondered, the fact that he came from North, and certainly his mother's bold, historic showing of the body of the open casket, he would have just been another Mississippi kid killed, wouldn't he? Another black boy dead.
I think you're right about
that. It's speculation, but it's my speculation.
I think so. The hero in the story is Mrs. Mamie Till Mobley, Emmett's mother,
yeah,
who in her grief says, you know, we've got to do something about this, and gets the message out.
There were extraordinary adult leaders that emerged in Mississippi, brave beyond belief. Obviously, Medgar Evers, one of the great heroes of, not even, hero is not even the right word, one of the extraordinary human beings of the civil rights movement in Mississippi. And the other is Bob Moses, a kid who came down from New York and assumed enormous moral guidance and leadership. But they nurtured the children, did they not?
They did. Medgar Evers in particular loved the NAACP youth councils and worked very closely with them and got to know the young kids who were involved with it, to the point that many of them sort of saw him as a second father, just developed that closeness. And Bob Moses, you're right, he grew up in Harlem and came down to Atlanta, where he met Ella Baker, the great Ella Baker, and she schooled him in that tradition of organizing, of going door to door. And he worked with everybody. So he worked with all of the people in the small towns of Mississippi, and that would include the young people who got involved. They worked, the members of SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, worked to get the young people involved, and Bob Moses was overseeing that work. So yes, those two really touched, you know, the hearts of a lot of the young people in Mississippi.
When you say involved, of course, a lot of it we hear about what Dr. King later did was voting, but a lot of the young people just went to the library. They had two libraries: the Black Library, which was under under everything. They didn't have the sufficient books for any research. The buildings themselves were inferior. And so a lot of the kids just went into libraries and sat there saying that they were studying and got arrested.
That's right. That happened in a lot of different places. One of the important ones to the Mississippi movement was a group called the Tougaloo Nine, Tougaloo being Tougaloo College, a historically black college in Jackson, Mississippi. And it's nine students. They were part of the NAACP Youth Council, so they're working with Medgar Evers. But they're college students, and they need books. And they would go to the black library, and as you point out, it was inferior to the white library, and they couldn't get the books they needed. So they went to the white it's hard to say, the whites only library in Jackson. They did what was called a read-in. They walked into the library to the amazement of everybody who was there. They sat down, they went to the card catalog, and the librarian told them they had to leave, and when they did not leave, the police came in. And they had been schooled in nonviolent practice, so being told to leave, they were not going to, but when they were arrested, they would respond. So I think 12 police came into the library and arrested the nine students who had come in to read. And that sort of sparked, it was 1961, that sparked a lot of what happened in Mississippi after that.
Why was Mississippi so ferocious? Clearly, any story about Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana were tough. But Mississippi stood out as the most ferocious, most violent, and most archaic in their response to any aspect of civil rights. Why Mississippi? Why do you have any insight on that?
That's a great question. That's one for exploring. I think, you know, part of it is that maybe it was more rural, so things are hidden more. Another thing, institutionally, the Klan existed in Mississippi, and they were active and ugly. They killed the three civil rights workers in 1964. But the other thing that started in Mississippi and I think spread to other states but was very firm in Mississippi, what was called the White Citizens Council, and that was the so-called respectable folks. You know, the mayors and the council, people on council, the store owners, lawyers, and they stood behind the Klan, not doing the ugly, the brutal murdering that the Klan did, but they did everything they could to reinforce the Jim Crow segregation. So if somebody went down to register to vote, their name would be in the paper. The White Citizens Council would go and make sure that the person who they worked for knew, and the person who went to register would be fired from their jobs.
So, and a lot of the kids who were in the early protests, their parents were frightened that they would lose their jobs and would, you know, the kids had to make a moral choice. Not, it wasn't even a moral choice, a pragmatic choice. Would their protesting create unemployment for their parents? That's real stuff that you have to deal with.
That's right. And yeah, the community, the black community was torn apart because of things like that. There was one of the people I write about is June Johnson, who in Greenwood gets involved through SNCC. She's kind of a rebellious kid and talks back to her teachers, to her parents. But then she gets involved with SNCC and becomes an activist. But it threatens her mother's job. Her mother is a cook. But her mother's an amazing person, Belle Johnson. She's an amazing person. She watches, slowly gets word. She gets to see that her daughter's involved with a movement. And eventually she becomes involved and becomes a cook for SNCC.
But you know, as I read the book, I realized people don't know that they're going through history or a historic moment. They're living their lives. So a woman who's a cook and is trying to make ends meet to feed her family, or the father trying to hold on to a job, it's very understandable that they would say to their kids, stay home because we have to feed you. We have to pay the rent. It's easy to look back and question why people didn't make some people didn't make stronger stands, but you don't know that you're in history and changing the world. You just do it, getting through the day. There were some extraordinary some of the young people that you profile. I was particularly fascinated. Indesha Ida May. What was her last name? Holland. Tell us about her. What her transition was fascinating.
Oh, she is. I use the word empowerment to talk about her. She started off. Her life was very sad. At 11, she was raped by her white employer, and then at 13, she becomes a prostitute. She gets expelled from high school. She's going to jail constantly. And then when she gets a little older, about 18, she sort of stumbles into the Greenwood office. She lives in Greenwood, Mississippi, into the SNCC office. And she's completely caught off guard. Her whole sense of black people is they're not worth much. She's internalized that. So when she sees a black woman typing, she can't believe that a black woman would be able to type and do it properly. So she's surprised that she sees this woman typing really fast, and then it's not gibberish that she's typing. She becomes involved with the movement. She's helping with voter registration. She's doing literacy classes. She's taking people down to the courthouse. So she gets involved with the movement, and that personal sense begins to change. She learns things like she finds out that black people have written great literature. Richard Wright, who's from Mississippi, she discovers at that late age. So she's beginning to change her mind. And to tie her story up, she goes on to get a doctorate. She goes to the University of Minnesota. She gets a doctorate in American Studies, writes a wonderful memoir from the Mississippi Delta. It's also a play. She is quite amazing. And one of the places I got introduced to her, there is an incredible...
She's alive? Is she still alive?
She is not. She is not. I so much was sad when I read of her death. She died in the around 2006. But she's in this documentary called Freedom on My Mind, and she just is a powerful presence in that documentary.
So many stories. Were they the McGee brothers? They just wanted to go to the movies?
That's right. They would have gone to integrate, I think, anything, but the movies were available. The movie theater was available, and Silas went there and just sat in the movie theater. Movie theaters were segregated. Black people had to sit up in the balcony, and he decided it was time that they were able to sit downstairs. So, yes, the McGee brothers, that was their main target.
I found that interesting because they didn't see themselves as activists. They just want to go to the movies.
That's right. But I do think they did see themselves as activists. Their mom,
Eventually.
Their mom was who had a farm. Her farm was the place where Bob Dylan and Pete Seeger came down and performed at their farm. So they sort of picked it up from her. They had a very strong activist mother.
You know, before she passed away, the late Carolyn Goodman, who was the mother of Andy Goodman, one of the three boys killed in Mississippi in the Freedom Summer, Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney, she went back to Mississippi for an event. I guess I don't remember when Carolyn died, but when she came back, she told me of the enormous changes in Mississippi. And I said, I'm not ready to buy all of that, because I hear some of their political people talking, but they've obviously elected a lot of African Americans as sheriffs and mayors. Have you been, and do you see the fruits of the efforts of the young people of the 60s?
It's sort of a subjective personal sense. I spent 3 weeks there in 2014, and then I came back for a quick visit in 2016. And we were living on the campus of Jackson State University. And, you know, just the whole feeling of being there, it was a very warm feeling. This was a group of mainly, it was mainly professors on campus.
But that's a black college. Is that a black college?
It is. It is. And we were very warmly received on the campus. And then when we went out into the community, and we went out the group was integrated, and, you know, it felt very, very comfortable. So the atmosphere I felt in Mississippi was warm. And I have a personally warm feeling. Every time I go to Mississippi, I just meet incredible people. So I have a warm feeling for Mississippi. It seems to have changed.
Robert Mayer, here's what I see. I watched an Ole Miss University of Mississippi, Ole Miss against Mississippi State football game, and it looked like all the players were African-American. But in the stands, and when they show you the student section, it looked very, very white. So I had the feeling that they were recruiting black athletes, but that other than that, that was just a glib observation. But it had some impact on me. The book itself is so important. Has there been any discuss about this being used in schools for high school students and college students to as part of the very provocative issue of giving some realistic perspective on our history?
For me, I'm a former high school teacher and a teacher educator. So it grows out of my desire to see this book at least read by young people. But I would love to see it used in the curriculum. I think it would be very appropriate. There hasn't been much discussion. I was doing a virtual conference from Mississippi, from Jackson. And somebody brought that up and said I needed to write a curriculum that went along with a book, which I hadn't thought about. But I think I need to think about that. This would be a wonderful. I think the book would be great to be used in high schools. So yeah, that was my intent. One of the things I hope would come out of that is we have this kind of our sense of the civil rights movement. It's taught us. You know, it's Dr. King and Rosa Parks and nobody else. And when you, if you read my book and you study Mississippi and also Alabama, you see it was very much a movement of the local people. So it's a very different image of the civil rights movement. And that's another reason why it would be important for people, young people, to read this in high school.
Yeah, I think it would be a great starting point, because I think once you read the book, which is In the Name of Emmett Till, that you want to go back 200 or 300 years and say, how did we get to this point where Emmett Till, that could happen to Emmett Till? But why this is would be a great curriculum. Not, it's a great read for adults, but for young people, it's because it depicts them as the agents for social change. It was the young people that came forward. Indeed, Medgar Evers and Robert Moses and a couple of other people, adults, were very important in that. And certainly the We didn't even discuss the assassination of Medgar Evers, which was, I remember when that happened, shot on his, he was coming home from a meeting, shot in front of the house with his Merrily with inside with the kids. Oh,
right. It's horrible.
And Brian Beckworth, was he the man who was charged, never convicted until years later? Was he what you had talked about, the prominent people in town with the White Citizens Council? Was Beckworth a, I don't know anything about him. Was he a prominent man or is?
I don't know. I don't know much about him. My sense is not, but I don't know.
Other than the fact that a college has been named after Medgar Evers, is his role in history known? If I asked young people, particularly young African Americans, would they know who Medgar Evers is, or has he been lost, as so much of history has been lost?
I would put a greater bet on African American students. But I think in general, we don't know Medgar Evers. We are glom on to someone like Dr. King because of his power and oratory. And Medgar Evers was a guy who organized. He went working door to door. So we don't really, I think for most of us, I would say both young people and adults don't know Medgar Evers. And he is such an important figure in the movement.
You know what resonated with me? I was, when you were describing the young people at the sit-ins in Mississippi, I couldn't imagine the terror. I participated in sit-ins as a teenager in D.C. when Washington was a southern city and was segregated. And we sat at People's Drugstore. And I saw the hate, but it was, we never had, I was never fearful that because I never felt that the government or the police would side with the people that were spitting at us and calling us names. I don't know why I wasn't fearful. I wonder if, and I kept thinking, I wonder if these kids in Mississippi, they had to be because they knew what happened to Medgar Evers. I was at sit-ins before Medgar was killed, but I was certainly aware of lynchings and killings. But D.C., I wasn't from there. I was surprised that it was segregated, totally.
Right. Right.
And I was there with a student group for the summer, and CORE trained us, as many of the kids in your book were. And right. CORE trained us in passive resistance and what to do if we were yelled at. And as what the only thing that happened to me is a woman spit in my face and called me a name. And I was told that was my Medal of Honor. It was, but it was chilling.
Yes.
But I wasn't afraid. But these kids had to be afraid, didn't they? Because what weren't they? When you talk to them as you do talk to a lot of them as adults, did they talk about fear or were they, or what?
Well, I didn't talk to people directly. I used interviews that were available online, but I certainly got a sense of how people felt and how people talked about their experiences. There's a sense of sort of a naive almost, it wouldn't be naive, there's a sense of fearlessness, of a bravery. There's the example you talk about, the sit-ins in Jackson in 1963 in May. They sat in a Woolworths, and this was an example. The White Citizens Council let people know what was going on, and the five young people sitting there were surrounded by a mob yes. of young white men, and it had to be if I were there, I would have been terrified. But
there's a picture in your book of the guy sitting there, and these were young people who from infancy knew that if they were on the sidewalk. Black kids that if they were on the sidewalk and a white adult came by, that they had to step aside. The DNA was one of fear, terror, and subsidiary of submission almost.
Right.
I, yeah, it's, I'm at a loss for words because I get so mad. When I think, how can people, quite simply, how could one human being treat another human being like that? But that seems to be the history of the world and of the country and the work that several people like Dr. King and Medgar Evers fought to change and literally gave their lives for.
That's right. And the sad truth is that some of the issues persist, but the upside is there are people who have the similar experiences. The three women who started the Black Lives Matter movement were responding to the awful murder of Trayvon Martin and the acquittal of George Zimmerman. So these awful things continue, but people continue to respond to it, which is, I guess, is the hopeful side of things.
Well, Robert Mayer, I hope maybe some of our listeners are education connected and can have some influence and campaign to get In the Name of Emmett Till into the hands of some young readers and some adult readers too. Listen, I'm not in my first blush of youth, and I found it an extraordinary book to read. And I was alive when Emmett was killed, and I remember the horror that many of us felt at that time, and then the picture in Jet. I'm going to, after we hang up, we're going to go to some Rosemary Clooney music, but I want to thank you, and then I'm going to tell people how they can get a copy of your book through WBAI. Robert Mayer, the book is In the Name of Emmett Till. It's How the Children of the Mississippi Freedom Struggle Showed Us Tomorrow. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much.
Rosie Clooney.
A girl went back to Napoli because she missed the scenery, the native dances and the charming songs. But wait a minute, something's wrong. Mambo Italiano, eh, mambo, mambo Italiano, go, go, go. You mixed up Siciliano, all you Calabrese do the mambo like a crazy with a, eh, mambo, don't want a tarantella, eh, mambo, no more mozzarella, eh, mambo, mambo Italiano, try an enchilada with the fish baccalà, and eh, gumba, I love how you dance, rumba. But take some of advice, Faisano. Learn how to mambo. If you're gonna be a square, you ain't gonna go nowhere. Hey, mambo, mambo Italiano. Hey, mambo, mambo Italiano. Go, go, Joe. Shake it like a Giovanni. Hey, look, as a deed, you get a happy in the feet. So when you mambo Italiano. Shake it cause I love her when you take a me. Mama say you stop or I'm gonna tell her papa and I hate Jadrul. You don't have to go to school. Just make a weed of beat a bambino. It's like a vino. Kid, you're good at looking, but you don't know it's cooking till you ain't mambo. Mambo Italiano, eh, mambo, mambo Italiano, oh, 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 you mixed up Siciliana, it's so delicious, everybody come capisce how to mambo Italiano. That's nice.
Rosemary Clooney, and if you want a copy of the book In the Name of Emmett Till, $50 to BAI, email me at drothenberg@fortunesociety.org. Give you a phone number. Hopefully you remember to give me your address, and I will get to you over the weekend. And I would hope there are some educators attuned. One of the emails said that I in my comments about the vaccination that I should be more understanding of people's distrust of the government. This is about distrust of the science, not of the government. Quite simple. Well, it's not quite simple. It's quite complex. But it's also about our lives. Well, Gary Null's on after me. You can hear that perspective. Everybody doesn't have to have the same perspective. He can share his. There are people in the news. You know, I was wondering why Gabby Petito, her death, her death, it was sad, tragic. I mean, that's so obvious. But I kept thinking there must be hundreds of youngsters missing. But it always seems like it's when that captures the media's fancy, the pictures, the family, the talk of a blonde, blue-eyed girl. And she was adorable, and her death is tragic. And then the Times did a story about a young girl who's missing, who is Latino, and another who's African-American. And it's created no buzz in the media. So when you talk about systemic racism, it's not even racism is not the word that covers it. It's selectivity based. I don't know. Maybe I should leave it up to all of you to determine how that works with the media. I remember when the Central Park Five case came, that woman that at the same time there was a black woman raped in Brooklyn in a similar situation, and it had no media resonance. Gabby Petito's death is horrible, and if finding the husband and all of that, but there are other people also in the news. His name is Cleet Keller. He's a 6'6" Olympic swimmer, all American. He's facing 20 years for his seditious participation in the January 6th uprising. He was tried and convicted, facing sentencing. Other people in the news, Daniel Craig. You know who Daniel Craig is? He's James Bond. He's announced that he ain't doing James Bond anymore, and he's going to be doing Macbeth on Broadway. Not my favorite Shakespearean play. Sidra Bell, this week, first African-American woman to choreograph at the New York City Ballet. It was called Suspended Animation, and it played on Thursday. Welcome to the world of celebrity choreographer Sidra Bell. And then one of my favorite persons in the news is, what's his name, Steve Mnuchin. He was the Secretary of Treasury Secretary. Reported, I'm sure he ran the Treasury with a great eye on your needs and my needs. He just sold his apartment on 71st Street and Park Avenue for $22.5 million. So those are some of the people in the news. In addition to the book In the Name of Emmett Till, which we're making available earlier, I announced that we have tickets for two shows. George Bernard Shaw's Mrs. Warren's Profession. It's coming to Theater Row on West 42nd Street. If you're ready to return to the theater, Shaw's play, which when it opened in London, was it 50 years ago, 75 years ago? No, must have been nearly 100 years ago, was closed by the aristocracy. Too shocking. Well, it ain't shocking anymore. Nothing's shocking. There's nothing that's shocking anymore. But the Shaw wit and political and theatrical class is in evidence in Mrs. Warren's Profession. We have tickets for the week after next. We're in October. Tuesday the 12th. Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday at 7 o'clock. Friday at 8, and a Saturday matinee and a Sunday matinee. So that's $50 to BAI, and you call us at, email me at drothenberg@fortunesociety.org. And I'll tell you about the other. Here's, who do we have musically? Al Hibbler, Frey, come back for an encore. Song of the Wanderer, Al Hibbler.
since you have sent me away. What shall I do when I do what I do, since you just hug me all day? Where shall I find what I found when I first met you? You are unkind, but I simply can't forget you. Where shall I go when I go where I go, since you have sent me away? Met you, you are unkind, but I simply can't forget you. Where shall I go when I go where I go, since you have sent me away?
Hibbler. Did you know that Louis DeJoy is still Postmaster General? I was surprised to learn that. I think it was Trevor Noah that made a comment that he was, remember the one that Trump appointed and wanted to slow down the mail? He's all in favor privatizing the post office. Well, he announced this week that mail will be delayed 3 days per letter. He just announced that we're going to slow down the mail. Can't Biden get rid of him? Doesn't he have the as president? Can he name who he wants to be his postmaster general? That used to be a cabinet post. I don't think it is anymore. But is he tied at the hip for life to that job? Let's get rid of him. Yesterday, I went to the National Jazz Museum in Harlem. Didn't know it existed on 129th Street. Wonderful. Oh, wonderful photographs. Just the pictures and obviously you can hear some music if you stick around and play, figure out how to play things. But I was being interviewed by John Riddick, who was doing a perspective. I wonder, what's the word that I want? A reflection on James Baldwin, how he tied into that whole era of jazz, et cetera. And I was on, I guess, as the oldest person they could find to talk about what the cultural scene was in music and theater at the time that Baldwin was writing. So it's a 90-minute piece done at the Jazz Museum in Harlem. And you can watch it on YouTube. I'll never see it because I'll never figure out. It's called Baldwin's Musical Harlem. And you go to YouTube.com/LRR8OPDSRs. I guess that's it. I have no idea how you would do it. But for those of you who know how to go to the YouTube, you see me and John Riddick talking about James Baldwin and the cultural scene that existed in Harlem at that time. I had fun doing it, if that counts for anything. And you might enjoy too. But earlier we announced that we have tickets for Between the Bars, Lynn Burns' insightful play that I saw with a dozen formerly incarcerated people from the Fortune Academy, from the castle. And at the HEAR Arts Center, you're practically in the waiting room of this county jail, and you watch the interaction between mothers and sons and girlfriends and boyfriends. And it reminds you, by the way, that when you go to a visiting room in most prisons, you never see men visiting. Where are the fathers, the brothers, the uncles, and the grandfathers? Not many. It's the mothers, the grandmas, the aunts, the cousins, the girlfriends, the wives. That's who's there. And I've gotten emails as we've been talking from listeners who have seen it this week, and they agree with me that this is the kind of off-Broadway play that was made for people of social sensitivity and a sense of real theater that BAI reflects. It's called Between the Bars. It's at the Heer Art Center. If you make a gift of $45 to BAI, you can get a pair of tickets. Here's what's left. I've been looking at some of the people calling. We have Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday at 8:30, Saturday at 4 and 8:30. Sunday's matinee gone, and next Monday. So if you want to see Between the Bars at the Heer Art Center, I urge you to email me at drothenberg@fortunesociety.org. Give you a phone number. It's a great way to support us and for you to get to the theater. An encore performance by Mickey Guyton, the young woman who has been proclaimed in the media in the last few weeks as the breakthrough singer, the first African-American woman in the genre of country and Western music to hit the charts. And here's her newest song. It's called Love My Hair. Mickey Guyton.
You want to touch it, don't you? Try to run your fingers through. Like the weight of your head could ever make you understand what it feels like to be a different just like me. You know the weight of your head could never make you understand the things I do to try to fit right in. I'm tired of trying to justify my skin. I used to think what God gave me wasn't fair. I braid it on just too high. No, I'm not scared to love who I am. I love my hair. If I could go back to 12, I would tell myself that straight up or down, baby, that's your crown. Whoever made up those rules, they don't apply to you. A straight up or down, a turn.
She loves her hair. Women and hair, I'm telling you. Did you ever see Chris Rock's movie about hair? Hysterically funny. All right, I'm going to play the role of consumer advocate. West Side Market, they I love the orange flavored Gatorade. It helps me from, you know, you have to drink a lot of liquids, water and Gatorade to fight dehydration. And I like the orange. And I've watched the day that they stack it. They will have 2 dozen of the orange flavor and then 2 dozen of the pink, whatever the pink is, the blue one. There's about 6 different flavors and they have 2 dozen of each. If you watch that in the morning, by the next morning, all the orange is gone and all the others are still there. So I suggested to somebody there, maybe you should order more orange. And they said, that's what they send us. Whatever happened to supply and demand? Of course, that's what they send us. Don't the people who sent, well, the delivery guy doesn't care. He just drops it off. But somebody should tell them that more people are buying the orange than the other flavors. Citarella steak this week, $44 a pound. Well, you could have a farewell to steak party. But then I went to Whole Foods, $20 a pound. Why the difference? By the way, Whole Foods, since taken over by Amazon, long, long waits in wait in lines because they don't hire as many people. Amazon profits over people. That's part of the game. And now one other consumer aspect. Well, this isn't really a consumer deal, but watching ads, do you notice that their insurance company, Geico, Progressive, Allstate, Farmers, they don't tell you about the product. They all have funny little stories. What are they selling? What is it? Geico, they could be selling shoelaces or toilet paper with their iguana or their other little projects. And I still don't know what Cars for Kids does with the money they get if you donate a car, that nonprofit with those little children, those irritating little children singing Cars for Kids. And they never tell you where the money's going. Unlike the St. Jude Hospital, where you find out. All right, final song before we close. Here's Il Volo with an encore performance.
Moonlight drops your colors in the dark, while the sound of silence in the wind feels like an empty song. As the rain begins to fall down like a million tears, and the heavens shining through the clouds, girl, I can feel you here. Don't you ever lose me, I could never lose you. Like the earth and ocean, we're the same devotion. You and me, we are love. Jete, mi amor, io ti amo. Over tears, so we can see the skies. When you ever feeling lonely and love just gets you down, hear the beating whispers of my heart. I'll know you've come around. I will always need you.
Women have been marching for our rights in the U.S. for over a century. In an act particularly defiant for a group that had been traditionally confined to the home, women marched in 1913 as Woodrow Wilson assumed the presidency and helped to turn the tide for the vote.
The morning shows a suffrage flag that bears a woman's star. Hurrah, hurrah, for equal rights, hurrah. Hurrah for the suffrage flag that bears the woman's star.
In the mid-1960s, a new women's movement was born and marched to announce itself. On August 26, 1970, the 50th anniversary of winning the vote, 50,000 marched up Fifth Avenue in New York City and 100,000 more marched in the rest of the country. The euphoria of that day is evident in a speech given by Kate Millett.
Today is a really beautiful day, right? We have a movement now. We're never going to stop. This is the 50th anniversary of the first movement and its death. And it's the beginning of the new movement. Today is the first day of our lives. From now on, we're a revolution. Today is the end of millenniums of our oppression. We will never be slaves again. What we're out to end is a whole system, and it's called sexism. It's like racism. And baby, it's hard to get rid of, but we're gonna do it.
One of the fruits of the movement was legalizing abortion, but it was attacked by the right wing almost immediately. And women have taken to the streets repeatedly defending that right. A huge march in Washington in 1989 brought together many parts of the abortion rights struggle, including black women who met separately and laid the foundation of the reproductive justice movement, and the right wing also showed up in droves.
We have to be clear that this struggle is not only the struggle of our right to choose what do we do with our bodies and our uterus. This is the struggle for human rights here in America, everywhere, in every community, in every street, in every neighborhood. Are you angry? Supreme Court says get back. We say fight back. Supreme Court says get back. We say fight back.
In 1997, over 750,000 African-American women marched in Philadelphia in what was called the Million Woman March. Issues included the rebuilding of black communities and the counteracting of negative stereotypes of African-American women. In 2004, the March for Women's Lives drew more people to Washington than any march had up until that time, an estimated 1,115,000. The framing of the march had major input from women of color organizations. Here is Loretta Ross speaking from the stage.
Okay, sisters. First of all, I want to say we have made a difference in this march because we changed the name from the March for Freedom of Choice to the March for Women's Lives. And that was done by women of color.
And in January of 2017, in response to the election of right-winger Donald Trump, who bragged of grabbing women by the crotch, a record-breaking 7 million marched worldwide, with approximately 5 million in the U.S. alone. And on October 2nd, 2021, as reproductive rights hang by a thread, we are taking to the streets again with marches in Washington and throughout the country. If you wish to participate, go to womensmarch.com. See you there.